From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
My fellow Americans, I must speak to you tonight about a mounting danger in Central America that threatens the security of the United States.
That was then-President Ronald Reagan more than three decades ago in March of 1986.
I'm speaking of Nicaragua, a Soviet ally on the American mainland, only 2 hours flying time from our own borders. To begin with, the Sandinistas have revoked the civil liberties of the Nicaraguan people, depriving them of any legal right to speak, to publish, to assemble, or to worship freely. Independent newspapers have been shut down. There is no longer any independent labor movement in Nicaragua, nor any right to strike. This danger will not go away. It will grow worse, much worse, if we fail to take action now.
As it turned out, most of what Reagan said was untrue about the Sandinistas and also about his own actions, since it was later discovered that for at least a year, he had already been forwarding arms illegally to a group known as the Contras, U.S.-backed guerrillas that were attempting to undo the revolution that took place in Nicaragua against the Somoza regime in 1979. Over the past 30 years, elections have favored both the right and the Sandinistas. The current government, headed by Sandinista Daniel Ortega, was first elected in 2006 and re-elected for 2 5-year terms, most recently in 2016. Ortega won with more than 70% of the popular vote, and his party, the Sandinista Front, took 2/3 of the seats in the national legislature. Since the Sandinistas came to power in 2006, Nicaragua has seen unprecedented economic growth, resulting in massive improvements in the living conditions of the masses of Nicaragua's people. This past April, some protests against a presidential decree regarding withholding for social benefits ballooned into anti-government violence across the country. We've been following that, and we're going to get an update now with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, who has been living in Nicaragua for most of the time since Reagan spoke.
We're right on the eve of the July 19th celebration, which is this year it'll be the 39th anniversary of the overthrow of the Somoza dictatorship in Nicaragua. So obviously the opposition here are doing everything they can to sabotage that event and make it either not happen at all or happen in circumstances that are extremely demoralizing for the government,
right,
and for anybody who supports the Sandinista Front political party. Normally on the 19th there's a huge demonstration. It often runs in a total of something like over 400,000, sometimes around 500,000 people congregate in Managua for that celebration. And this year is likely to be a very, very big number of people indeed, because they're determined to show the coup mongers, the people that they call the golpistas. Golpe is Spanish for coup.
Right.
So anybody who supports the coup is called a golpista.
Yeah.
And the Sandinistas here want to show the golpistas that they are well and truly defeated. And so for their part, the golpistas obviously are intensifying their actions to try and both disrupt normal economic life, normal social life here in Nicaragua, and also radically disparage and discredit the government at an international level. And there are many aspects to that. But the fundamental thing here is that while in the first couple of weeks when the coup started back in April the 18th, there was a lot of uncertainty among the general population about what on earth was going on, because it just came out of nowhere, the coup attempt, and based on the flimsiest of pretext around a social security form that subsequently proved to be completely irrelevant to the coup agenda of the political opposition here in Nicaragua. They couldn't care less about social security form. What they wanted was the government out, Daniel out.
Right.
That's what they wanted. And so, although the government called for dialogue, the opposition didn't respond to that in a positive way. And that fact as well as the extreme violence that they used and the systematic intimidation that they installed in the country through roadblocks that prevented ordinary people going about their everyday life. Those two things led to a really quite rapid loss of support, whatever support the opposition ever had from at the start, that just dissolved away. And what they were left with was the 30% support, political support, that they've always had in the country in electoral terms. But and even that now, it's not clear what their level of electoral support will be until next new elections are held, whenever that may be, because people are so alienated from them for the what they've done to the economy. They've destroyed the economy. Tourism, which is a very important component of Nicaragua's economy, has been wiped out as a result of the coup. And tens of thousands of people have been thrown into unemployment. The economy minister, Ivan Acosta, about a month ago, reckoned that the total unemployment could run into 200,000 in a country of 6 million people. You know, 200,000 people thrown into unemployment would be a big deal even in the United States. For Nicaragua, it's a disaster if it comes about.
Right.
So we'll see what happens. But the nitty-gritty is that the political opposition here responsible to the coup have very, very little popular support at grassroots level. And what that means is that while the government has tried to maintain the dialogue, the opposition realized that their only trump card, if they had one at all, was their ability to intimidate the local population and hold a pistol to the head of the government to negotiate by means of the roadblocks and the violence. But when that became clear, and when they initially agreed to dismantle the roadblocks but then went back on that agreement, refusing to honor it, the government then stepped in and said, right, well, if you're not going to negotiate in good faith, we've got to restore economic life and protect people's basic rights, so we're going to clear the roadblocks, and that's what they've done.
Right.
So in the course of that, of course, there was some loss of life, a minimal loss of life, among opposition activists, none of whom are students, by the way. There was never a student massacre. Student support for the coup dropped away very quickly in the first month, so that by mid-May, there were hardly any students involved in the kind of active opposition protests, especially on the roadblocks. And so who were the people operating the roadblocks? Well, they were paid delinquents, extremist opposition activists, people with nothing better to do, you know, who the ni-ni, the youth who are neither studying nor working. And that explains why in many cases it was very easy for the government to dismantle the roadblocks, because most people were not committed to the political cause. They were either paid to be there or just there for no good reason at all, and only the opposition extremists were the ones committed to trying to maintain the roadblocks. Now, what happened last week on Thursday, as that process developed, it became clear that the opposition got absolutely desperate about how they were going to maintain the image of this repressive government attacking peaceful protesters, which is they has no traction at all here in Nicaragua, except among the diehard opposition.
Right.
So what they did was they attacked a police station in a remote municipality in the east of Nicaragua, it was a place called Morito. I doubt if anybody outside Nicaragua even knows that this happened, because it wasn't reported by the corporate media deliberately. Let's talk about the human rights organizations later. But what happened in Morito was that a gang of at least 100, maybe more, opposition activists from the anti-canal group led by Francisco Ramirez and a guy called Medardo Mairena, they've been operating the roadblocks and intimidating the local population in eastern Nicaragua, in the area between Chontales and Rio San Juan. And that's Let's talk about that in a minute. But those activists, very heavily armed, attacked the police station, killed four police officers. They then attacked the Alcaldía, the local municipal office, and they killed a primary school teacher and wounded four municipal workers. And they also kidnapped nine police officers who were unable to defend themselves. And they took them to the roadblock that they were operating at, a place called San Pedro de Lovago, which is completely under the control of Francisco Ramirez and Medardo Mairena. So these supposed peaceful demonstrators, right, somehow turned up in Morito, heavily armed, killed numerous people, including police officers, and somehow these unarmed peaceful protesters carried off nine police officers, six of whom subsequently were released with injuries. Okay, so that is what the peaceful protest movement really is here in Nicaragua.
Yeah.
But it's represented in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, in the Guardian, in Al Jazeera, in any corporate media is represented as peaceful protesters.
Yeah.
So that is the bloody reality.
Yeah, that's the same scenario that they've done, let's say, in Ukraine and Syria, where they've been caught after the fact. The people that were shooting at it. As a matter of fact, if you go back to the coup in 2002 in Venezuela, the same thing. There was the video that supposedly showed Sandinista supporters shooting at protesters, peaceful protesters, and it turned out, somebody produced a video zoomed out of the whole picture, not just the way it was framed, but of the whole, you saw that it was actually the protesters, quote unquote, who were armed and shooting at the police and at the innocent bystanders. And so this, it's the same thing. It's done in essence to stir up anger at the security forces, so that the anger itself becomes manifest in protest action and in joining the uprising, quote unquote, and B, making it impossible for the police and the security forces to restore order, because every time they attempt to do that, they instead face a reaction from the people who think that they're being violated instead of protected.
Right, and of course there's a very clear pattern to this, and the deceitful lying propaganda provokes fear, and that fear generates hatred, right? And the hatred, and that's how it works, kind of. The lies turn into fear, and the fear turns into blame. People throw the blame on the government, as you explained.
Well, the actions,
and that turns into hatred.
Yeah, the actions
and
in the street do this, too.
That's the cycle that we've seen everywhere, and we're seeing it here in Nicaragua. And yesterday evening, I put up a bunch of material about demonstrating very, very clearly how the downright lies about the occupation in the university. I'm going to put up some more material today on the site, demonstrating the deceit that's involved. But also, when you look at the output of organizations like Amnesty International, for example, the behavior of Bianca Jagger and this group that are calling themselves SOS Nicaragua at an international level, and if you look at the way The Guardian and the New York Times and all those NATO propaganda media are portraying what's happened in Nicaragua. The whole object of that is, at an international level, there are various components to what they're trying to do. One is they're trying to cover up the reality. And the reality is that the sheer invention in many cases, not all cases, there have been cases of protesters obviously being wounded and killed as a result of this extremely violent conflict, and that would happen anywhere. But what they're trying to cover up, apart from the deceit, is their own human rights abuses. Essentially, Amnesty International, and this shows how far we've advanced now into a kind of post-truth world. The Amnesty International, this human rights organization, is covering up extreme human rights abuses by the opposition with whom they are now politically identified.
Right.
So, for example, you've had yesterday with another savage example of a police officer tortured, set on fire, and murdered by the opposition that Amnesty International are apologizing for internationally. Mm. So Amnesty International is now covering up extreme human rights abuses. That's where we've got to now.
Yeah, we saw this in Syria, by the way, Syria and Iraq.
Extreme human rights abuses. So, yeah. And what are we talking about? You're not just talking about one murder here or one murder there. You're talking about the systematic murder of police officers, the torture of police officers, publicly. They do it publicly on the barricades, but Amnesty International, Bianca Jagger, they don't care about that because they know it'll never get reported.
Right.
The Guardian and the New York Times will never report that the opposition here systematically torture Sandinista supporters systematically murder police officers. They will never report that because that undermines their big lie.
Right.
A deeply disturbing detail of this is that the Catholic Church has been directly involved in the torture and the abuse.
Yeah.
People were tortured inside Catholic churches, Don.
Yep.
No, and there's video of priests being present as people are being tortured.
It's amazing.
So the Catholic Church here in Nicaragua is at rock bottom in terms of credibility.
Mm.
And so there's that aspect that Amnesty International, the NATO propaganda media like The Guardian, Al Jazeera, essentially now they've become right-wing media. People, progressive people still fool themselves into thinking that The Guardian is a progressive paper. Forget it. The Guardian is a ruthless, unscrupulous NATO propaganda outlet, just like the Washington Post and the New York Times. The Washington Post over the weekend published a report by a guy called Paltrow about an alleged attack on the Divina Misericordia Church in Managua, and that too was completely fake. And the people doing the shooting were opposition activists, and the priests cowering inside the church were play acting. And that's what Paltrow falsely reported.
Whoa.
But anyway, that's the propaganda aspect covering up the extreme human rights violations by the Nicaraguan opposition. Now, what is that all about? That is just a superficial layer that's covering up the reality of what the United States and its allies are trying to do to Nicaragua within the overall context in Latin America of this persistent, enduring offensive against anybody that tries to argue for a progressive solution to Latin America's problems of social and economic development.
Yeah.
And what is that about? What the United States has lost Eurasia. Let's put it in those crude terms.
Sure looks like it.
So what are they going to do? How are they going to kind of sustain their economy and their influence and status in the world? Well, obviously, they're going to try and recolonize Latin America. I mean, it's the easiest thing to do. But even there, and as you and I have talked about for months, and even the right-wing Latin American elites see that there's not much future banking on the United States economy, so they're going to cut deals with China and the other Asian countries. So that makes the United States even more desperate. Why should they care about a tiny country of 6 million people like Nicaragua? Because they're absolutely desperate. Their system is in a state of an accelerating decline, and so they need to prop up their their speculative finance-based economy as best they can throughout Latin America. And that is one of the fundamental things that's happening here in Nicaragua.
Yeah, and that happens in this context. You've had everything that's developed since 1998, 99, when Chavez took over the reins in Venezuela. Essentially an awakening, a liberation of the region from U.S. direct U.S. control, a move towards both defense of each other's sovereignty and of the region as a whole, and then engaging the rest of the world, which means you saw China in particular start reaching around the area and making deals with these various countries and starting to lay the groundwork for real deep integration of Latin America into the global economy on a standalone basis. In other words, as its own player. And one of the primary gateways, as we know, into that in terms of infrastructure development was that canal through Nicaragua.
Right.
And so thwarting that is like physically closing the door off to the further development of relations between the rest of the world and Latin America. And the same can be said for the transcontinental railroad that China wants to build from the Pacific to the Atlantic, with the recapture of Argentina, for example. There's a move towards that. The way that they've based most of their efforts in Peru also is a base towards that. And their refusal to let go of Colombia also shows that move.
Yes, and if you look at everything that's happening, Don, and it's like, and what was that character, that sports coach, a guy called Yogi Berra? It's deja vu all over again.
Yeah, Yogi Berra.
And if you look at what's happened in Nicaragua, where have we seen that before? Well, we've seen it in Haiti, we've seen it in Honduras, we've seen it in Libya, we've seen it in Syria, we've seen it in the Ukraine. Mm. And it's just over and over again. It's exactly the same scripts or screenplay, if you like. Mm-hmm. And people still fall for it. They still fall for the big lie.
Well, they're replaying it in Haiti again right now. As we speak, they're replaying it in Haiti again.
Right. So, and the other aspect of it is the economic stroke financial aspect. And if you look at Argentina, well, there's the IMF. They've just made the biggest loan or line of credit that they've ever done, certainly in Latin America, of $50 billion to try and protect Argentina's economy. Ha ha. As if the IMF could give could care less, to avoid a vulgarity, about the well-being of ordinary people in Argentina. Why, what a joke. When has the IMF ever cared about anything except money?
Right.
And protecting the wealthy elites. And here we go again in Argentina. It's like a replay of the 1990s. And when, at the end of the 1990s, the IMF stepped in, I think it was 2000, they stepped in and tried to prop up Argentina's economy. But that was a fake, because all they did was they propped up Argentina's economy with sufficient money to give the elite enough time to get their money out and turn it into dollars. Michael Hudson's explained this very well. I think there's a piece out that he's written, or he's explained this in the past very well, but there's a good piece today on naked capitalism about, I think they lifted it from some interview with Michael Hudson. But Hudson has explained that what happened in 2000 was that the IMF gave the elites enough time to get their money out and turn it into dollars so that they could buy Argentina's foreign debt. Right?
Yep.
So the foreign debt wasn't sold to US speculators or European speculators. Right. The greater part of Argentina's foreign debt at that time was sold to the Argentinian elite and the Brazilian elite.
Right.
And they are the ones that were bleeding Argentina's economy dry until Nestor Kirchner took over and brought some order and some rationality to the situation.
Right.
But now you have an almost exact replay of what happened back in 2000. Mauricio Macri has negotiated this credit line with his buddy Christina, what's her name, the head of the IMF.
Yeah, Lagarde.
And they're going to do exactly the same.
Yeah.
With that money, that'll give the Argentinian elites enough time to get their money out at a good exchange rate, buy dollars, and then they'll use that to speculate against their own country's economy.
Right. And
what happens.
That's the first half of it. What they're doing is they're using half of the First purchase is $15 billion out of the $50 billion, okay? Half of that is used for quote-unquote budget support, which does exactly what you're just talking about. It keeps the floor under the value of the things that have been purchased already by Argentina's elite so that that doesn't tank in a deteriorating economy, which the reforms, quote-unquote, in other words, the undoing of the reforms that bailed out Argentina last time, those reforms are creating social tension and also tanking the economy. Those two things are like a paired twins. And so the other half of the money that they've got, well, that's of a third, okay, half of a third. The other half is going in to try to make up for some of the public things that have been stripped away, the supports for pensions and other things. And then what they're doing is that's one third of the total 50, roughly 15, 17 billion. They're keeping the other in the bank for the next two and a half years as the what the IMF called a systemic transformation of its economy. And they're keeping it to mitigate social tension. In other words, to try to float this government into the next election in case the economy collapses enough where the people decide to throw them the hell out. And so
they haven't a snowball's chance in hell of making that work. Just look at Greece.
Right.
All that's going to happen is that $50 billion will get used up in the next speculative crisis over the next few months.
Right.
And then Argentina will be going back to the IMF for more money. Well, and when we know that, and that's like, it's just so obvious what's going to happen. It just happens over and over again. It's like Groundhog Day.
Yep.
But what you have just described, and what I tried to describe, but you explained it better. What you've just described is that is why Bianca Jagger and Amnesty International and The Guardian and all the others are apologizing for the crimes of the, or covering up, trying to erase the crimes of the Nicaraguan opposition here.
Right.
That's why Lula stays in jail and there's constant repression from the Brazilian justice system against every attempt to achieve justice for Lula. That's why in Colombia, the peace agreement with the FARC has only been 20% implemented.
Right.
Because if they were to implement the agreement in full, the local Colombian oligarchy would have to cede a certain amount of power, which they're never going to do. Now, that's why Lenin Moreno has shifted so far to the right that he might just as well have run on the same ticket as his opposition presidential candidate back when Ecuador had their presidential elections.
Mm-hmm.
But he fooled everybody and deceived everybody, pretending to be progressive and an ally of Rafael Correa. Now, the latest marker of that, the latest indicator of that, is that he's now asked UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations, to hand over the UNASUR headquarters so that he can turn it into some kind of educational facility for the Ecuadorian government.
Right.
If he doesn't, he won't do that. He'll privatize it. He'll sell it off to somebody.
Yeah, it's like here in New York, if the U.S. decided to turn the United Nations into a charter school.
Right. So, what's happening in Nicaragua, what's happening in Argentina, what's happening in Brazil, what's happening across the continent is it's a kind of multifaceted expression of that deep underlying reality. I think it's really important for people to understand that, because it's what it represents. What it means is that nothing that people read in their foreign news coverage corresponds to what's really happening here in Nicaragua, in Argentina. People have to look underneath the superficial reports and find alternative sources of that report the reality in order to have a chance of understanding what's going on in Latin America and the Caribbean.
We'll talk with you again next week, Tony. Thank you very much, and stay safe.
Okay, thanks a million.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.